This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. There is a new podcast in town.
This is a show for you, whether you just moved here like myself or you've been here your whole life. We hope to bring you conversations and stories that help you get settled or understand the changes happening around you.
That voice? Host Daryl C. Murphy in the first episode of WBUR's The Common, which is a new daily news and culture podcast. It launched today. And from the newsroom, Daryl is here in Studio 2 to talk about The Common and what it takes to host it. Daryl, welcome.
Tiziana, thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
It's great to have you here. Congratulations on the first day.
Thank you. Thank you. I don't even know. I don't think it's hit me yet.
Yeah.
That the show is up and running. So I hope the people like it, you know?
It's been months in the making.
Yes.
Literally.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of practice and trying. And, you know, shout out to the newsroom and the bosses at iLab for letting us consider this as a little experimentation laboratory, you know, where we got to try out some stuff and figure out what we want our voice to be. So I think we got to a good place. And, you know, the show is up and running and we're still tweaking. We're still working. So, you know, what you hear now is just the beginning. You know what I mean?
So let's take this. We got to a good place, right? So You did host Consider This. There's Morning Edition. There's All Things Considered. There's Radio Boston. There's Consider This. The Common is none of those things. So in just a couple of words, how would you describe The Common for listeners who haven't heard it yet?
It's a conversation between, you know, it's like you're at a dinner party or something like that. And, you know, when people are leaving and then you might see your friend and you pull them aside for that last 15, 20 minute conversation, you know, just to kind of just before you guys go, you really talk about the real thing you want to talk about. That's what this is. You know, this isn't just I ask a question and, you know, the person gives an answer. Like, we really want to have conversations. We want people to feel like they're listening in on that private conversation between, you know, a journalist who knows their area of expertise so well, right? But, you know, maybe they're just loose and they're able to talk to you about it and have fun with that information rather than worrying about, like, here's all the information and stuff. Like, we want to talk. We're people. And we just want to talk as people about these stories to make it more digestible and to make sure that it sticks. Because there's just an overload of news and information out here right now being thrown at people, you know, but it's not being communicated to people. It's not inviting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing. So today's the first episode today. It's on question four and how, you know, Massachusetts Latino population thinks about question four. It's not long and it's not short. It's really digestible. It's about 11 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak with the head of El Planeta. So one voice diving deep and having done debates on question four here on Radio Boston, all the key building blocks you need to know are there, but it does feel like, and my Midwest accent will come out here, a chat.
Yeah.
Feels like a chat.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's all we want, you know? I mean, a lot of people, you know, podcasts are big, right? There's just so many podcasts nowadays. And we just want to set ourselves apart by offering information that people can use to make sure that there's some value there for them, but in a way that is just easy on your ears. And it's in the morning, you know? I want this to be the first thing you listen to, and I want it, so it has to be kind of fun and engaging, you know? Fun where appropriate. Some things we can only be
right,
but so loose, right?
That's right.
But I want you to have that human element, you know what I mean?
So let's tell a little more about the human.
Yeah.
Right? Let's talk a little bit more about you. I mean, you're inviting people to start their day with you on a podcast. So what do you listen to when you're not doing The Common?
Oh, man. When I'm not listening to The Common, I like to listen to other podcasts. I'm definitely listening to things like It's Been a Minute. You know, that's been kind of a North Star for me. You know, I think I can speak for the team as well, you know, looking to keep that casual feel. And also, I listen to, of course, I listen to Up First and stuff like that, The Daily and all of that. But also listen to some music, you know. I like to just zone out, listen to some jazz, you know what I mean? Sometimes I listen to some books or something like that. So a little bit of everything, you know.
So you came from Philly.
Yep.
You've been in Boston, what, about 2 years now? Is that right? You came right around the start of the pandemic.
Yeah, I came here last September.
So it's only, it just seems like just longer over because year, yeah. time has lost all meaning during the goodness. Pandemic. So are you starting to love Boston, or do you feel like you have to hold on to Philly in your heart for a while longer?
Yeah, I don't think, Philly's home, you know. I grew up in South Jersey, so Philly is always like right there for me, you know. And having lived in Philly, went to school in Philly, like that's always going to be part of me. But I feel like I'm still getting to know Boston, figuring it out, and where my place and my community is here, you know, outside of my professional network, right? So, I think that's what makes the show so interesting, is because I'm using that perspective, because I'm still trying to understand where I'm at, you know, where are the things that I'm interested in? Where are my people? Where is all those things? And like, what are the issues that I need to be aware of as I'm living here? And also, like, how can I be a good resident? You know, I don't want to be somebody who just moves to the city, is taking up space and you know, looking for stuff that's not meant to be here, right? Like, yeah. That's how you become kind of a drain, and like, you become a part of the problem where longtime residents start to get pushed out and feel alienated. I don't want to do that. You know, I'm coming with so much humility and curiosity just to be a good person while I'm here. You know what I mean?
So let's play a lightning round. So on each of these, let's just do like a one word or one sentence answer. We'll have fun with a couple of them. First, two of our favorite questions. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Iced or hot?
Hot.
Yes. Oh, we are new friends.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. The book you can't put down.
Oof. Right now, I am taking my time reading A Little Devil in America by Hanif Abdurraqib. I think his pen game is just so delicate and just clear. I love his writing. It's just, he brings a sensitivity to it that I really, really appreciate.
You tweeted last week that you wanted some Scrapple. So first, tell people what it is.
Oh, man. I don't even know what Scrapple is. I mean, It just tastes great.
I think it is a spammy kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like it's a pork. It's
kind of
like it's like
thing,
a sausage
right?
brick. Yeah, it's a Pennsylvania Dutch thing. Even though I was introduced to it down south, but yeah, it's like it's a Pennsylvania thing where it's just like this brick of pork leftovers. It sounds gross.
I was going to say, Daryl, you are not selling
but
it.
It's delicious. If you can eat a hot dog, you can definitely eat Scrapple.
And we are speaking, by the way, with Daryl C. Murphy, colleague here at WBUR from The Newsroom, where The Common, the new podcast on news and culture, launched this morning. Did you find Scrapple? Have you found Scrapple in Boston?
Nah, not yet.
All right,
not
folks,
yet.
That's the challenge. Anybody know where Daryl C. Murphy can get Scrapple in Boston? All right, so Daryl. I'm imagining that there was a dream when you started all of this, so the kinds of stories you most wanted to bring to people when you invite them to this chat first thing in the morning. So give me a couple of the dreams for you.
You know, I think for me, it's the people I'm talking to that I enjoy so much. You know, the story is just a reason. You know what I mean? If I'm on the show with somebody and they're excited about their story, no matter what it's going to be, I know it's going to be a good show, you know? Yeah, that's what I look for. Because, again, it's a part of that conversation. Because, you know, if you tell me, if somebody comes up to me and tells me, hey, there's a crisis in, I don't know, paper or something like that, or there's, you know, something that sounds maybe not so exciting, but you're excited about it, I need to know why you're excited about it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then 9 times out of 10 in that conversation, I'm going to leave excited.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. That's what I look for, those kind of stories.
Can you give us a sneak preview when you're really excited about coming up?
Well, I'm a bit of a transit nerd because I used to
be a transit reporter.
Yeah,
here
I used to be a
WBUR.
Transit reporter here. And so we just taped an episode with Taylor Dolvin from the Boston Globe about the T and, you know, its relationship to the election, you know, because the next governor has some say in that. So we had a real nice conversation about that, and it was just very chill, very loose, two transit nerds just, you know, talking about the tea.
Fantastic. Daryl C. Murphy is host of WBUR's new daily news and culture podcast, The Common, joined us from The Newsroom. And you can find The Common on our website at WBUR.org under podcasts or wherever you subscribe to your podcast. Daryl, thanks.
Thank you.
We turn now to the city of Boston.
One man is dead, another has life-threatening injuries after 6 people were shot in Boston Sunday night.
Sound there from WCVB reporting on a stunning hour in which six people were shot during three separate incidents in Dorchester, Mattapan, and Hyde Park. That's after an incident on Friday.
Police are investigating a deadly shooting near Back Bay. Officers say that one person has died.
And a shooting this past Wednesday. And thanks to Boston 25 News for that sound. Police are asking for help with leads. City officials are calling it unacceptable. Still, this is one in a string of weekends and weekdays of tragedy in this city upon a hill. We dove beneath the headlines on gun violence in Boston recently, and in the wake of more shootings since, we want to pick that conversation back up today with a focus on supporting community, listening to residents, and understanding what has to happen now. We have three guests. First, back in Studio 2, a guest from our last conversation, Representative Liz Miranda of the state's 5th Congressional District, which includes Roxbury and Dorchester. A native of Roxbury, actually graduated from the John D. O'Brien School of Mathematics and Science. Welcome back to Studio 2.
Good morning.
So two additional guests with us here today, Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, who is founding pastor of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. She also serves the city of Boston as the chief of environment, energy, and open space, and often joins us here on Radio Boston. Reverend Mariama, welcome back.
Good to be here.
And with them, Justice Porter, a senior at the Jeremiah E. Burke High School. She's here today with the consent of her parents and her teachers to participate in today's conversation. And we've spoken with Justice on air before about her poetry about gentrification. Welcome back to you as well, Justice.
Nice to be here.
So I want to thank all of you for being here, and I'm just going to dive in by just checking in with you, Justice. I'll start with you. How are you?
I'm all right. Granted, after everything that's happened over the weekend, I think the normalization of everything, I'm still kind of in that headspace, but it is still tragic, and I still feel the effects of that.
And I think I misspoke and might have said you were a senior because all kids are seniors in my head right now because I have one. So I apologize. You're a junior.
Yep.
Thanks. You know, it's a lot to leave your school, come here. We're putting you in a studio. We're talking about something that's hard and traumatic. You're sharing how you feel. Do you feel held and supported in your community right now, Justice?
I do. And I think a lot of people don't understand that there are areas in Boston that you can feel supported, especially for the youth, but I do feel it. But I also do see the students, my peers, that don't feel supported.
So, Liz Miranda, I'm going to move to you. And I'm actually thinking about a conversation. So we talked a couple of weeks ago, but I'm also thinking about a conversation that we had on Friday here in the studio. We were talking about Portraits and Pride and the vandalism of the Portraits and Pride. And one of our guests was sitting here in the studio and said, this is the wrong conversation. Everybody wanted to talk about it once the vandalism started. We want to talk about what the exhibit was in the first place. So I want to ask you today, 2 weeks later almost, what is the right conversation? What's the conversation we should be having right now?
I believe that we need to be having a conversation about the truth about Boston's history. Many communities that have been redlined or had discriminatory housing practices or dealing with the structural and systemic racism, just like where I grew up in the Dudley Triangle, are more violent. And we need to be having a conversation about the root causes of violence. Communities that are highly resourced, where folks can get a therapist, can get the right access to the physical health care that they need, they can live in a safe and thriving community, are less violent. And I don't think we're having that conversation enough. Additionally, the second conversation I think we need to be having, both me and Rev Mariam are former youth workers, and I guess we're always youth workers. And the idea is that the best antidote to a young person experiencing generational trauma is having a loving, caring adult in close proximity to them. And so the healing-centered work that I think Boston needs to do needs to start yesterday. And I believe that as we're working to a trauma-informed approach, because this is a public health crisis, that we need to be thinking about how we're actually addressing the generational trauma that many people in our community have faced.
So, Reverend Mariama, I'll turn to you. And we often turn to you as a pastor in these moments, in part because I know you think with the heart of a – does that make sense, think with the heart of a pastor? But I think it does.
Yeah.
But you also are seasoned as a pastor guiding your community as traumatic events happen. But you are also a youth worker. Mm. And so what is the skill set that you're turning to most in this moment, and what's the message you're most trying to communicate?
Well, I think you know, to what Rep. Miranda just listed up, the reality is that folks are hurting. You know, I think the pandemic was tough. I think a lot of folks are trying to put their lives back together. I think young people had really tough school years of like for two straight years. And, you know, people, it's really cliche, but true that hurt people, right? And that we have a lot of people that are not in like the best place, right? And then the resources have also been constrained. So I think part of my message to like my parishioners, to people I see, is to take the time. If there's someone in your life, reach out. Just give them a call. I was at an event on Saturday where we were unveiling a part of Alma Park that was named on behalf of Eddie Matthews, who was gunned down last year in August. And, you know, his son was there and had just also lost his best friend to gun. It's just like there's just it's pain on top of pain. And so really, really stopping to listen to one another, to take care of one another is the sort of person-to-person work that we have to do. But there's also a lot of policy work, a lot of organizing work that we need to do. So I don't want to pretend it is it's one or the other. But right now, I'm mostly sitting with people who are in a tough place, and I'm reminding them to make sure that they drink water. I'm reminding them to make sure they take some time to get some sleep. I'm reminding them that it's okay to cry, and that when you hold it in, that's when it comes out in funky, scary, terrible ways. So if you're feeling bad, that's actually normal. That's natural. It means you're actually human. But just don't do it by yourself. Find somebody that's willing to talk with you and be with you.
So we're speaking with Reverend Mariama White Hammond, founding pastor of New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, Representative Liz Miranda of the Suffolk Fifth, and Justice Porter, who's a junior at Jeremiah E. Burke High School. And we're continuing our conversation about the ways to understand, respond to, and support neighbors in the spate of violence we've been seeing in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Hyde Park this weekend. Justice, I'm going to turn back to you. What do you most want to be hearing and seeing from the adults in your life right now?
I want to see a focus on the youth, right? So I think while people may think, oh, I'm paying attention to these teenagers and these kids, I don't think on a certain level that they really are, because us youth really have a hard time with the generational trauma and seeing and the normalization of therapy and counseling isn't, it's not normalized, right? So I want to see more support in that aspect, more adults telling us, hey, it's okay to see a therapist. Hey, it's okay to reach out and not make us feel like a burden or not make us feel like we're a bother, because we aren't. And if we don't interject and we're not saying, hey, you can feel this way to our youth, they're just going to keep that in again, and it's just going to repeat the cycle.
Do you feel after, and our listeners may or may not realize that there was a stabbing at the Burke inside the building, there was a shooting outside the building. Do you feel like the attitude to students represents a place of care or a place of worry, suspicion, fear? How are you feeling like you're getting received?
I feel like it's more suspicion than anything. After those events, a lot of people have turned to the Burke or turned to our neighborhoods and been like, you guys are bad and this is how you're portrayed, right? But that's not how we're portrayed, and that's not how Boston is. That's not how Dorchester is. And I feel like there should be more of a positive attitude, because it's not just those events that happen. There are so many good events and so many good people that show up for our communities, our schools, our city, and they aren't being shown.
So I'll turn to you, Rep. Miranda. It is this, how do we carry forward the both and? I'm thinking about both you and Reverend Mariama talking about there are immediate pastoral needs, trauma needs, care needs, and policy needs around dealing with systemic racism, dealing with a history of disinvestment, dealing with a lack of policies that are supportive today, and the need to not pathologize neighborhoods as being places of violence, mm-hmm. but vibrant communities that are experiencing moments of violence. That's a lot for anybody to hold in one place at once. How do you do it?
So I think first we need to acknowledge that our traditional model and sort of this myth of public safety and prevention of gun violence isn't working. The state of Massachusetts rests on its laurels a lot. We have the lowest number of gun deaths per capita, and we have tough gun laws. But for the communities experiencing growth, like for us, 58% up on fatal shootings, 38% on non-fatal shootings, the availability of high-capacity guns in our communities, while it's very difficult to get a legal gun if you're a professional. So our traditional model isn't working. We're further criminalizing people. If you know anything about living in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, we're the most policed, most incarcerated. I think it's some average like 45 to 60% of the Massachusetts prison population includes folks in our communities. So I look forward to working with the new administration, and I see hope. I see hope with Maura Healey and Driscoll understanding that when we're addressing violence, it's about improving all aspects of someone's life. And I want to speak as an elected official. There isn't one elected official that isn't thinking about this, but I want to speak to the philanthropic and the business community right now. You may not think that this is an area that you need to be focusing on, but as someone who also worked at the Boston Foundation, who was a youth worker for 15 years, we can't have thriving communities that are not safe and not healthy. And so whether you live in the Back Bay or you live on the Blue Hill Ave corridor or you live on Beacon Hill, everyone should be paying attention to what's happening in every neighborhood in the city of Boston, because we all have a role to play. So I look forward to going back next session and reinvesting on grassroots, preventative, collaborative risk mitigation, which I believe in, which are hub models to address families, not just a person who is inciting violence or has been impacted by violence, but their entire family and entire community has a role to play in ensuring that kids like Justice can go to school at the Burke in Grove Hall and not have fear that something is going to happen to them outside their building.
So we also spoke last time we spoke with you, Rep. Miranda, with Reverend Kevin Peterson, who's the founder of the New Democracy Coalition, focuses on civic empowerment with a focus on Boston's Black community. Here's a little bit of what he told us in our conversation 2 weeks ago.
I've taken the pains to go out to the crime scenes of these murders over the last 3 weeks just to get a sense of how the community is responding, and it's not well. There is a deep sense of anxiety and pain and fear. And frustration. And if we are to be honest, we must say that there is a great deal of distrust between the community and between the police and City Hall. I've heard it.
And he's been organizing a series of private and confidential community meetings with residents to design an action plan, called for parents to impose for their own kids and families a curfew over the weekend. I want to play one other piece of sound, and then I'll turn to you, Reverend Mariama. This is Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden speaking to WCVB last night in Mattapan, which is the scene where the shooting was fatal last night.
We need the community support now more than ever as we continue to face these incidents of gun violence.
I want to be very clear that you are here in your capacity as a pastor and an activist in your community. There is both of those things reflect lack of trust, lack of trust with institutions, lack of trust with law enforcement, maybe lack of trust with some elected officials. Mm-hmm. We've been diving for years on the show into where that comes from.
Yeah.
What's the first step in rebuilding? Because it feels pretty urgent to rebuild some of those threads quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so Liz and I grew up in the 90s when it was significantly worse than it is now. And I think the reality is a lot of folks got locked up, a lot of people that we knew. My high school years into college, I visited so many different prisons, like learned all the rules, what you can wear, what you can't wear. And I think there is a sincere sense in the community that we are maybe marching our way back to those days. And a deep concern, because those were really challenging times. So I think the question is, how do we intervene now before we get to the point where, when I was growing up, it was like literally every day, and it does feel like we're moving in a negative direction. So I think there's a number of things. I do think that there's reparative work that has to be done with leaders, But I also want to note, because I think sometimes people have underestimated how much was done by people in communities, and particularly women, mothers, who were really active. A lot of kudos, and I'm not knocking, has gone to pastors and to the police, but I was a young person in that time, and I saw a lot of women in our lives stepping up and never getting acknowledged, and I saw a lot of young people leading in some powerful ways, and I'm not sure that we were acknowledged. I was one of the young people at Morning Star that they wouldn't let in because it was a pastors-only conversation about youth violence, and I said, how are you not allowing young people into a space that's talking about these very issues? So I think we need to have some intergenerational conversations within the community, because I think if we can't even trust each other, how do we move into a trusting conversation with folks in power? And I'm not saying we're going to work everything out. You're never going to get to the place where everybody's on exactly the same page.
No city.
That's not a. That's not reality.
Anywhere, right?
But I do think there's some reparative work that needs to be done at the community level, particularly between young people and the adults in those same neighborhoods. Because I know a lot of young people who are angry because they feel like the adults are quick to call the police on them, right? Justice. Not to engage and not to have a conversation. And I don't want to let off the hook the work that needs to be done with the police and city officials, but for us to speak with a somewhat united voice, we need to repair some of those internal conversations. And then I do think there's a whole conversation that needs to be had about how do we get justice without over-policing, right? Because to Justice's point, if young people feel like everyone's suspicious of them, they're not going to participate in that problem. In the solution. If they feel like we're saying it's them that is the problem, how do you get them to be a positive part of moving forward? So I think there's a lot of reparative conversations. And quite frankly, sometimes they're not best held in big community meetings. Sometimes they are not best held when the media are there. They are often best held on the street in small groups, building trust, building relationships, so that we can then mobilize those into those larger conversations.
Turning now to Justice Porter Jr. at Jeremiah E. Burke High School, a lot of nodding there. So let me let you pick it up and take it where you want to go next.
Yeah, so I think back to what Reverend said, there is like a very big disconnect between generations in the community. So you may have a child and their parent and their grandparent. There is a major difference there, obviously. But then when it comes to trauma and violence and things you may see in the street, that's an even larger disconnect. And when I see people in my own community, say in Grove Hall, it's as if I can't relate to these older generations. We may see each other and we may like see the news, maybe something bad happened, but we can't relate and we can't sit there and talk about it.
What would help?
I think more support and more something that would bring together everybody. And I think a large part is getting all generations to be a bit more open-minded when talking to each other and kind of trusting each other.
So, Liz Miranda, I'll turn back to you now. You know, you resident, neighbor, elected official, activist, you come to this with the experience of a lot of hats. And now we have this intergenerational trust building conversation that we're having too. What can you do on that front? And what models have you seen for the intergenerational piece of this that you think we could amp up?
You know, I recently went to the national conference of the HAVI, which deals with hospital-based, the community violence sort of ecosystem between communities and hospitals. Anyone that has a penetrating wound goes to a Boston hospital. Particularly Boston Medical Center sees 85% of the folks who are shot or stabbed in our city. And one thing I learned from that is that we can't always focus just on prevention, just intervention. We have to bring people to the table that are either perpetuating the violence and offer them an alternative. And many times, like Reverend Mariama, I've lived with incarceration my entire life. Like, I'm a whole senator-elect right now, but my father and my oldest brother were deported and incarcerated. My second oldest brother was just released. I was the only elected official in the state of Massachusetts that had an incarcerated sibling in the Massachusetts DOC system while I've been a representative. And I lost a brother to homicide 5 years ago. So I am deeply traumatized, but also deeply hopeful that understanding that if this is a survivor-led, community-centered, grassroots approach, we can get to zero. The problem is that many times those with titles, including myself, are brought to the table, whether you're a pastor, you're in law enforcement, whether you're an elected official or a deemed leader by your community, you're running a civic association, are brought to the table, yet we're not talking to the young people who are in DCF custody, who are in DYS custody, young people who have served time in our county facilities or our DOC facilities, and say, are you okay, first? But second, why did you do this? What made you pick up a gun and shoot? And you hear lots of things about, I was underhoused or unhoused. I never got the mental health support. I lost my uncle, brother, or dad 10-5 years ago, and no one came to save me. No one came to help me. No one talks to me. When they see me walking in community, people cross the street. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense of abandonment. And I believe collective community care is where we need to go. All of us have a role to play. You know, I tell people all the time, I was in bed last night and hearing about the shootings, and I physically had a reaction. Mm. Because the young man who passed away on Saturday at Tent City, or the young man who died in Mattapan, they had a story. They had a family. Many of them maybe have children. And what you have is the next day or that evening, someone has received the worst news of their life. And how do you go on? It always stays with you. And so I make a commitment. You know, I'm not a person that makes promises all the time, but particularly when it comes to gun violence, I make a promise to go into that state house and say, we're doing this wrong. Wherever we're funding, we need to change where we're funding. If we're working on gun reform legislation, we need to be working on prevention and intervention more. We had a historic $50 million investment in reentry and gun violence last term, thankfully to Chairman Rodriguez and Chairman Michaelowitz. But we need to be looking at where we went wrong. Because obviously, when you have 6 shootings in an hour and a half, in 3 different city neighborhoods and another neighborhood the night before, we obviously as leaders need to reinvent and reshape how we're addressing our communities.
So Justice Porter will give the last word to the youngest generation. What's one thing you'd like the people around you to begin doing differently now?
I want them to realize that we're all human and that we all are willing to support each other. It just takes one person, maybe giving a person a sticker. Honestly, it could make that person's day even brighter, and that influences other people to make even better decisions.
All right. Justice Porter is a junior at the Jeremiah E. Burke High School. Representative Liz Miranda represents the Suffolk 5th District, and Reverend Mariama White Hammond is founding pastor of the New Roots African Methodist Episcopal, or AME, Church in Dorchester. 3 women speaking truth to us about what needs to happen next. Thanks to all 3 of you for being here.
Thank you.
The Boston Celtics nearly won it all last season, and they had high hopes for this year. Now they could be playing against the head coach who got them there, as credible reporting suggests that Ime Udoka, suspended for a year for an inappropriate workplace relationship, could wind up coaching the deeply troubled Brooklyn Nets. Well, then this weekend, the Boston Bruins decided they would not be outdone. An electric start to the season did not stop the Bruins Friday from signing prospect Mitchell Miller, who had already been let go by the Arizona Coyotes after reporting revealed a history of racism and bullying against a black school classmate with an intellectual developmental disability. Over the weekend, fans, media members, even some of the Bruins' own players expressed what sounded like dismay, and last evening the team reversed and cut ties with Miller. This is a familiar pattern in Boston sports. I'm thinking about the winning New England Patriots and Antonio Brown, for example. So, should our teams do better? Do you want them to do better? Where does winning fit in our collective moral landscape? We knew who we wanted to ask those questions. Howard Bryant is ESPN senior writer, sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Howard, welcome back.
Hi, Chisiana. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, and I appreciate you joining us. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So listen, we actually reached out even before the Bruins thing, right? We were just going to do the Udoka and the Nets. And
you had a feeling, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes. And then, wow, the Bruins come out on this. So let's start there. First, why would a team sign someone with that kind of baggage that's so thoroughly reported that another team dumped them in the first place?
Well, if you listen to Cam Neely, president of the Bruins, and he said this was the biggest miss of his career as an executive in the NHL, and that he's deeply apologetic and sorry and is going to reach out to the family of the young man who had been the subject of this bullying by Miller. And I think that this is I have to admit, Tiziana, I am conflicted about a lot of this, and I'll tell you why. On the one hand, this is something that we deal with in sports all the time, and also in a society. What do we do with people who have done things in their youth? I mean, we go back to, you know, you bring up Antonio Brown with the Patriots, but you go back when Bob Kraft first bought the team with Christian Peter, and Myra Kraft, the late Myra Kraft, came in and said, we don't want him on our team because of his past. You go look at Luke Heimlich, who was a pitcher back in, it was Oregon State, where it was revealed right before the College World Series that he was a sex offender, and then no Major League Baseball team has touched him ever since. And so on the one hand, you do have to ask the question, okay, what were these teams thinking? But on the other hand, as a society, you also have to think about what do we do with these individuals, especially when they do things so young? What Cam Neely had said was, I was under the impression that he had been working on himself. And one of the things that I haven't seen in any of these stories, and I'm looking and I'm not judging any of this, I need to do more, find more information on it, was where was that evidence that he had been working on himself and that he had been trying to improve and had been going through training and all of the other different things that we talk about as necessary for rehabilitation. On the other hand, people do treat this as they treat professional sports, because the money is so big, as a privilege and not a place to work. And so therefore you are completely disqualified. I think that obviously the Bruins made a huge mistake in their vetting process, but I think the larger question of what do we do with people in these situations remains.
So I want to pick up on that. And we're speaking with Howard Bryant, ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. And we're looking at the stories of the Bruins and the Celtics most recently, but a longer set of issues in sports and Boston sports around these moral challenges. You expressed some, ambivalence, Howard, is my word, not yours. And I'm going to play a little from Cam Neely, who's the team president, this morning. He did a press conference where he addressed what had happened over the weekend. Here he is.
100%. And that's, one of the reasons why I was, at the end of the day, okay with a 14-year-old kid, now 20. And, I do believe in second chances, but maybe some don't deserve it. And I'm not saying that in particular in this situation, but I do believe in second chances.
And his 100% was the first time he was asked if he believed in second chances. And there's this deserve dimension of this that is subjective and with lots having opinions, Howard. And I'm going to come right into a second cut and then turn back to you, because this is a bit of sound of Patrice Bergeron, the captain of the Boston Bruins, talking with reporters on Saturday about the signing.
In a way, I think I was not necessarily agreeing with it. And to be honest with you, I think it's the culture that we built here goes against that type of behavior. We expect guys to wear this jersey to be high character people with integrity and respect. That's how they should be acting. And so my understanding is that he's going to put in the work and development programs and community programs to better himself, and it's up to him to do that. Hopefully there's some growth and change. If it's the same 14-year-old that would be walking into this locker room, he wouldn't be accepted and wanted and welcomed in this locker room.
So, both partly reflecting what you said about, has he done the work? And according to O2K Sports, the agency that represents Miller, he has sought help from a number of organizations, but there's no confirmation of that. One of the organizations, though, the Carnegie Institute, says he contacted them about possible work but never pursued it. So is this a moment where we've got a debacle with the Boston Bruins, but we could be seeing something 6 months from now that's different if there's more information out there where that second chance happens? Or in this sort of world, this social media world and the moment we're in, is he done? And is that right or wrong?
Well, I mean, I think there's a few things there. One, I love Patrice Bergeron. One, he's the captain. He's going to the Hall of Fame. And this is what we mean by leadership and character. And what he's essentially saying is that this is a character organization. And these words are not platitudes. This matters. We expect you to be a real person of substance. And I really appreciate him saying that because they are trying to set a standard. And one of the things that we talk about in sports all the time is this talent trap. And you see it with athletes, because if you're that good, you get to be bulletproof. You get to do and say whatever you want. And I really appreciate, Bergeron really making sure, at least in his mind, in his comments, that this is not how he operates, that they do want high character. But the thing is that we've seen this across the board. Look at one of Boston's most famous sons, Mark Wahlberg. Same thing. He had serious issues when he was a youngster in terms of racial slurs and battery and assault. And he's one of the country's most famous actors. I do think that it is a larger issue outside of sports. But I absolutely believe as well that we do live in this culture where people, I hate the term cancel culture because I don't believe it really exists. I believe that there's an accountability here for who we are and what we've done and all of those things. But at the same time, I also think that we are in a period, and this is why you do hear my ambivalence, that I'm always very conscious of corporations protecting themselves and not taking enough time to think about the individuals. It's easier for them to just cut bait on people instead of, it's too toxic, we don't need the grief. That leaves a lot of space to hurt people who are also hurting. And so I'm of the mind, when I listen to Bergeron on this story with the Bruins, I assume that they had more information and knew that this kid hadn't been redeemed yet, that he hasn't done the work. That was what I took from it. I'm always worried, however, that industries see the backlash, they see what's out there, and they're like, we're not even going to investigate, which is why I'm always very conscious and worried about what is out there publicly against, if the organization's got information behind closed doors that they don't want to be public, but they've made their decision, I'm hoping that that information is legit.
So then that brings us to this interesting moment with the Boston Celtics. And we talked with you here on Radio Boston when the Celtics first announced that they had, in fact, done an internal investigation, the details of which they were keeping private. But as a result of that investigation, determined that head coach Ime Udoka had an inappropriate workplace relationship and was being suspended for the year. And now we have credible reporting, including from ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski, that the Brooklyn Nets are looking at Udoka for a head coaching job there. So a team that takes a strong stance, does its internal investigation, and then an ecosystem that says, we either believe in second chances, or maybe in the case of the Brooklyn Nets, we don't care.
Yeah, and also there is a distinction here, obviously, huge distinction between what Udoka was happening in the Miller situation. But it is true that the NBA didn't take any action against Udoka. So whatever was going on between Udoka and the Celtics internally, the Nets are looking at this like, well, that's a Celtic issue. And the league is looking at it like, that's a Celtics issue. But when you look at the Miller situation, even the commissioner, Gary Bettman, was like, what are the Bruins doing? So you could tell that part of what Neely is going up against here is the league has decided that Miller is not playing in the National Hockey League. The NBA has not decided that Ime Udoka is not coaching in the National Basketball Association. And both of these situations we have to rely on what these institutions know. And clearly whatever is happening, either, you're right, Tiziana, either the Nets are like, well, you know what, it's not that big a deal, and we've got real problems over here, and he already coached here, and we really like him, and we're going to give him a second chance. Or they may look at it as, this is something that is benefiting us, we don't really care what happened in Boston, and that's that. And if that's the case, if the latter is the case, and Udoka really is a toxic character, and something else surfaces, if this job comes through, then the NBA has exposed themselves to exactly this conversation that we're talking about, the dark side of all of this. What are you thinking in terms of vetting the people who work for you?
So we are speaking with Howard Bryant, ESPN senior writer, about this dark side of betting. Excuse me, vetting after, although we may do betting at another
in
time.
Sports these days and
that's
betting
right.
too.
But vetting around, and in this case with two Boston sports franchises, the Boston Celtics and most recently this weekend, the Boston Bruins, who signed a player known for having done some extensive racism and bullying against black
classmates.
Could
I say one other thing,
yeah,
Tiziana,
jump
as
in.
Well, really quickly? And also, this is another example of the public. We spend a lot of time as individuals thinking, oh, well, we can't do and we can't say anything and everyone's so powerful. One of the things that turned the tide in this with the Bruins is the outcry from the city of Boston, from all different corners, and people made their voices heard, and the Bruins had to respond to that. Had no one said anything, maybe this goes in the other direction and he's still with the organization.
So Cam Neely apparently was asked today if Miller would still be on the team if there were no backlash. And he essentially said, we signed a player, right? Which suggests that had there not been this backlash, you're right, he'd still be there. Are you pleased about that? Do you believe fan communities and hometowns of sports teams should have that kind of influence and power?
I believe they should have influence, and I should believe that we should listen. I don't believe they have absolute power. I think we have to pay attention to all of it, because let's not forget that there was a huge number, there's a big number of people out there that didn't want Colin Kaepernick playing football. So the public voice is not the only voice, but it is an essential component to any sort of community.
So before we let you go, Howard, we've got a little less than a minute left. I noticed you're leaving Twitter.
Yeah.
Are you doing that today?
In about an hour or so, I think the 24 hours is up. Yeah, I mean, once again, we talk about values, and we talk about, it's very difficult to walk the walk if you're not willing, what's the point of saying it if you're not going to do it? And I think that what's happened on Twitter now runs counter to how I feel about the world. And so there was social media before, there'll be social media after, but it's just not for me anymore. And I'm going to miss it because I really, really enjoy the community.
All right, that is Howard Bryant. He's ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. And every once in a while, we get lucky enough to pull him into Radio Boston when we really want to think hard about something that's happening in sports. Howard, as always, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tacci and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.